Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, The Last Laugh is on a much-needed vacation this week. But with the Emmy Awards coming up next weekend, I wanted to repost the fascinating interview I did with comedian Rami Youssef last year, just before the first season of his show Rami was about to premiere on Hulu. Since then, his career has just absolutely taken off. Rami surprised pretty much everyone watching by winning a Golden Globe in January for that show's first season. Now he's nominated for 2 Emmys for the second season, Outstanding Lead Actor in a Comedy Series and Outstanding Directing for a Comedy Series. The great Mahershala Ali also scored a Supporting Actor nom for his incredible performance as Rami's Sheikh. When we talked last April, Rami was just about to fly out to Chicago to tape his first hour-long special Feelings for HBO. Here he is talking about his family's unlikely connection to Donald Trump.
So I grew up with this photo in my living room of my dad and Donald Trump shaking hands. I saw it every day as a kid. And when you're a young Arab kid, anyone who's friends with your dad, like, that's your uncle. And last couple years, I'm watching TV and I'm just like, Uncle Donald?
So I hope you enjoy this conversation, and we will be back next week with an all-new episode when my guest will be, wait for it, Pauly Shore. We're just a few days away from the premiere now. How are you feeling?
I'm excited, man. It takes so long to go from even thinking of the idea to then pitching and doing the whole process. It's just like years. And the fact that finally people are going to get to see it is really cool. It's also kind of surreal because I do stand up. So it's like stand up, you do it. You have an idea in the morning and then you go up and you get a reaction. With this, it's like the laugh comes 2 years later.
Yeah. How long has this been in the works, Rami, we should say, on Hulu?
Well, I think this incarnation of the show, the first document that I kind of put together for it was probably like November 2016. So it's a couple of years, but that's actually fast even for TV.
Yeah. And I know Gerard Carmichael, your fellow stand-up, is involved in some way. So was he involved early on or how did that kind of happen?
That 2016 fall, I was opening for Gerard on the road.
Oh, nice.
He was prepping his HBO special, and I had acted when I first moved to LA in the multicam on Nick at Night. It was like a family sitcom. And so I had had multicam experience, and I love multicam, and he obviously does too. And so we had early on kind of daydreamed a block of like the Carmichaels and the Youssefs, and we kind of like do a back to back. But then I started putting together what I wanted the show to be, and it became pretty clear like, oh, this isn't gonna work as a multicam. We're gonna need a little bit more flexibility and tone.
Yeah, I think his show is kind of a rare example of multicam in this modern time that really did work. But that's definitely hard to pull off. So once you started putting together and deciding that it was not going to be a multicam, what did you want it to be? What were the sort of the earliest like ideas of what this show would look like?
Well, I knew that we kind of are a little bit in the era of like of dramedies in a sense. Mm-hmm. I knew that I liked the idea of it being grounded, but I also didn't want to forget that it should be funny.
Right.
And so it was like, how do we create that vibe, but not forget the jokes and not shy away from the jokes? Like, it's okay if something's just straight up funny. I think a lot of the more dramatically set shows that come from comedians or that, you know, have that perspective, or they really sometimes feel, I don't know what the reasoning is behind it, but I'm always like, oh, I wish there was just like one or two like straight up comedy scenes in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that tonally we wanted to play in that space. And then I knew that I wanted to make something that reflected more of my experience. Like I wanted something that had a first generation kid who isn't trying to erase the culture and faith that he comes from, but is actually trying to synthesize it and have it be a big part of his life. And so that was really the voice for the show that I knew worked in stand-up and I knew we needed to have on TV.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting you say that because I've been lucky enough to see all 10 episodes of the show and really, really loved loved it. And it's hilarious, and it's also really dramatic at points. But I think the thing that's so different about it is that it is this depiction of what it's like to be, you know, Muslim this age in right now that we haven't seen before. So how important was that to you in terms of showing that on screen and having that representation out in the world?
Yeah, it was super important. I mean, like, I wanted to make something that showed, you know, this is like an Arab Muslim family in New Jersey. It's pretty limited in terms of what it's showing, you know? There's not really like a Muslim community, right? I mean, there's so many different cultures.
Right.
And I mean, most Muslims in America are black, you know? And so it's like, really, this is a limited look at this kind of family, at this kind of guy. And it was really important to me to show something that had some sincerity of somebody trying to adhere to their culture and their faith, because that's how I feel in my life, you know? There's what I believe, and then there's what I actually do. Mm-hmm. And there's a space in between that. And what I actually do, I don't think is, it's not like I think that's right.
Yeah.
But, it was really one of the earliest conversations I had with Gerard, because Gerard and I were friends for years before we worked together. We would just talk about faith, and, you know, he's grew up Christian and believes in God, and I grew up Muslim and believe in God, and we were like, but you know, there's never anything that shows the way we think about God where there's this guilt and there's this thing rattling in your head and you want to do the right thing, but we're also just like everyday people, and most depictions of anything religious are like the priest who does cocaine or like the blown out version of heaven with angels and like a comedically long piece of paper with all the good deeds and bad deeds you've done and these things that are like removed from reality. And so it was like really exciting to be like, okay, what does it look like the way we think about it every day? What does it look like to just be someone like me, and I'm just really overthinking this relationship, and it's not just because of her, it's because of what I believe, and where does that fit into the narrative? That was a big goal for me.
I want to know who I am. I want to explore.
You're like the kids in Egypt. They throw down the government, big revolution, then what? No plan.
I don't know what I'm doing, man. I look at my parents and how strong they are and how they just know everything's gonna be okay because they have God. And yeah, I have sex even though I'm not married.
Where are you gonna go?
So what? Is that means I'm not a good Muslim? I'm just like trying to be good.
You jerk off too much.
Does it? It's funny that you mentioned having Gerard as someone else in the comedy community who believes in God, because I think people think that almost comedians as a whole are this atheist community. It's a very, you know, non-religious community in a lot of ways. Has it been hard for you to be religious and a comedian at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, church is a punchline. Like, you could put that at the end of a joke. It's like, then I took her to church. Like that sounds like a joke, you know, from somebody. And I get that. And religion as a force and as a industry and as a presence has done a very bad job. I think that the communities around pretty much all of the major religions have done a good job of fucking it up. Mm-hmm. And so I don't blame people for the way that they feel. And I don't think that it's all executed properly. But I also don't think it's all understood properly. And so for me, so much of what was exciting to figure out on stage was I would say I believe in God, and it's not like it would be hard, but it would be weird. Like, like to just be like, no, I genuinely do. And you just, and it's like, you're at a bar in Brooklyn and everyone's like, well, why are you here? You know, like there's like this odd thing that happens. I mean, I remember like just being on lineups where people were talking about the craziest shit, man. Like, oh, I took acid, I did this, I did that. And it's hilarious. And then I'm like, yeah, I'm fasting for Ramadan and, you know, cause I want to, and not cause my parents made me, and it's just kind of like, oh, okay. Like that's, you know, awkward. It's like, is this punk rock? Like, it's very, I wouldn't say it was hard other than more, it was just different. And trying to talk about it in a way that can hopefully just bring a little bit of levity to it and understanding to it. But I'm also not like in the business of being like, believe this, or it's not even so much dissecting the religion. It's really dissecting my own intentions within it. And so I think if something's self-reflective, the umbrella it's under is just the first layer. So you don't even, okay, fine, you're not Muslim. It doesn't really matter. You know, it's just like, are you somebody who thinks about what you're doing and if that's right or wrong? Are you somebody that wants to be somewhere that you're not? Are you somebody that is trying to figure out, you know, the best way to go about being a person? And that stuff sounds vague, but it becomes really specific once we put it under this umbrella. And that's my approach.
Yeah, I mean, and those are all the things that your character, Rami, is dealing with in this show. And I think the question with a lot of these, there's been a lot of shows where comedians play themselves, from, you know, Seinfeld to Louis to Gerard and all these people, is the question is, how close is that character to you?
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did you kind of deal with that? I mean, this character doesn't drink, is struggling with whether to have premarital sex, you know, all these kinds of things. Does that really mirror your life? And how much of yourself did you want to, were you like, was that scary to put that on screen in that way?
It's definitely scary. I mean, it's interesting, like, the reality is, for me, I am a creative person. You know, I've been in the comedic world or in the world of making things and using making things to express my feelings. I've been doing that for like 10 years, maybe a little more. So that's always been the way I process things. So I think because of that, I've been able to be more in touch with my feelings and kind of have solutions and understand what's going on with me. But I wanted to create a character that could have been my life if I didn't have the ability to pursue those things. And so what would it look like if you didn't have that outlet? I think I would be a little bit more stuck. Mm-hmm. And so this show and the character in the show, I think all the emotions are really true. They're all things that I felt, and they're all things that I've been through on a level. But we take them to a place that my real life wouldn't have really allowed, because I kind of knew how to deal with it. And I have a family that's really communicative, and I have a, you know, a really strong support system in my family. And there's very little that I feel like I couldn't tell my parents if I had to. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to put this character in a place that was just a little less developed and a little less open, a place that I know a lot of people are at. And so that was the choice in not making him a comedian. That's the choice in kind of having him be at this stuck place a little bit more, and that being kind of a more fun place to grow out of.
I noticed at least one review comparing the show to, like, as if it's a Muslim male version of Lena Dunham's Girls.
Oh, really?
And I'm curious what you think of that as a comparison.
Oh, that's really funny. I think I watched the first season of Girls. I thought it was really good. So that I didn't keep watching, but I not because I didn't like, I just, you know, there's so much stuff. But I, oh, that's cool. I mean, I think maybe that comes from, you know, I remember watching that pilot. I think it's a really good pilot.
Yeah.
It's a really good pilot. And I think it was like, oh man, you're watching people have conversations that you kind of knew they were having, but now you're getting the real details of them. And I do feel like our show can do that. I mean, a barometer that I've always had is like, okay, so we're in Hollywood, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this want for diversity. And let's say you've been banging around Hollywood for like, you know, 10, 15 years. You are a really good white dude writer. And at this point, you were kind of like, you know what? There should be a show about Muslims, or there should be a show about Mexicans. And you're a smart writer, so you could probably write a show that is your idea of what you think a Mexican family talks about or a Muslim family talks about. It'll be structurally sound. It could be funny. It uses human dynamics that, like, everybody uses. So I would put my show always through that filter, which is like, could that guy in Sherman Oaks write this scene, like, with what he kind of knows from the outside?
Yeah,
like, could a really good writer, like, write this scene in my show? And if he could, then we don't need it. Like, I can only write things that only somebody who's me could write, or only someone from my community could write.
Can you think of an example from the series where you said, oh, only I could write this?
Yeah, I mean, we have a whole scene about foot washing at the mosque and the intricacies of doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a lot of what I think are really amazing moments between, you know, in even we have an episode with my sister where, like, we really get into the guilt of being a Muslim woman and the pressure that's put on you. And there's a lot of specifics in there. And there's a lot of specifics in our Ramadan episode.
You really gonna be one of those Ramadan Muslims, okay? You can't be jerking off all year, then all of a sudden turn into Malcolm X. Thank you, Rana. Habibti, tislamideke. Here you go. Sahtain. Enjoy that.
How long ago did
Look,
I order?
It's all about intention. You place your order before sunup. You're fine. Slam it there, kid. Oh, here you go, all right? By the way, all that app shit, most of it is garbage. How do you think they did it back in the time of the Prophet? Look at that. That's how they did it. That's real Muslim right there. That's old school. Walk out, sun's up. Hey, guess what, guys? Don't eat. Sun's down, eat. It's very simple. You don't have to complicate things, right? He knows what I'm saying.
Is it time?
Too much light pollution. Can't tell if it's the sun or that new Target that opened up on 17. That shit glows, man. So I stopped eating an hour ago just to be safe.
Like, I think an outsider Ramadan episode would be, oh man, I'm hungry. This isn't really about that. This is about a whole other type of hunger and a whole other type of struggle and really pushing the show to those places where it just feels, I want it to feel as tailored to my actual, you know, thought process as possible. And I think that's what's amazing about a show like Girls, which is like, oh no, only these girls could have written that. You know, that's what was so cool about it. It's like, oh yeah, no one could have fucking guessed this conversation. You know, like maybe we had an idea, but like, wow, it's so cool to see the details.
Yeah. And that show specifically got some criticism for being too white, not diverse enough. And what I always thought about that was they were reflecting a reality of those girls in Brooklyn, you know, having this very white life.
Yeah.
So for them to falsely fill the show with diverse actors may have taken away from the realism of it in some ways.
Absolutely. I mean, I think like there was almost something about that critique that even would push me to like name my show Rami. Like I didn't run to be like, oh, I want to name it after myself. But it was also like, I can't call this Muslims.
Right.
You know, because it's not. Yeah. Again, this is Arab Muslims in North Jersey and maybe only one type of family in that place, you know? And so I think the criticism of something like that is more so just the umbrella where it's like, maybe that show should have been called Gentrified Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And then it would have been like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Not trying to be so universal.
Yeah.
So going back to that, you know, your specific story, can you talk a little bit about where you grew up, what your childhood was like?
Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in New York, but we moved to Jersey early. I was in like first grade. And I love New Jersey. It's a really amazing place. I mean, our town was pretty diverse. I mean, I think we were one of very few Arabs. There was like one other family, maybe two other families. But I still felt like this bond with like Italians. I was like, oh yeah, we're this, like, you know, we're the same, you know. But then the big difference too growing up is like this lack of Christmas is horrifying, you know, as a Muslim kid. And my best friend growing up was Jewish because I really think because we both didn't do Christmas. It was just kind of like, dude, we're in this together. Like we're in this shit together. But I loved growing up there and it was, both my parents are from Egypt, but they met in New York, which is like very representative of my family, which is like, we're people who will take a risk to go across the world, but also once we get there, we need the most familiar thing possible. And so there's this half like massive risk bravery, and then the other half like, but let's make sure it's like, you know, what we know.
Yeah. And when did comedy come into your life? Did you love comedy growing up? Did you have people that you particularly loved?
I didn't know a ton about comedy other than my uncle showed me Carlin really early. I was probably like 9 or 10 and I was listening to Carlin rant, and I thought it was so funny because my uncle speaks in probably like a very similar comedic voice to George Carlin. Like he can just go on a rant on something and like, and it's funny. Like he's like the funniest person I know.
Yeah.
Like him, my dad, my other uncle in a room is like way funnier than any comedian's green room I've ever been in. Like they're just so funny, and that was probably the main exposure I had to comedy. And then I didn't really start listening to stand-up or consuming it until I was probably like 17 or 18 outside of that. You know, there was a couple Carlin albums I like listened to, but I really started looking at it, you know, I think around like middle school. I like bought a camera. I was like really into making things, and I'd kind of go around town and like shoot. I remember I used to like follow the mailman and like narrate like that he was doing crazy shit. And I'd like make these little movies on Windows Movie Maker. And then in high school, I was really lucky to have this like amazing TV program and learned how to edit and do all this stuff. So I knew I like wanted to make stuff. And then once I could drive, I used to sneak from Jersey and go to UCB Chelsea in New York and see stand-up. And I remember like I was like 17 when I started going, and I would just see these amazing comics. I would go to Whiplash. There was this show that they did Monday nights in New York at 11. And you know, my parents would be asleep, or if they were awake, I'd be like, no, I'm just going to my friend Muhammad's house, and then I'd go into the city and just see. It was cool. There was like a bunch of comics that like I really liked. Like it was like Leo Allen and Sean Patton and Aziz, and it was just really amazing seeing these people, and then like 2 years later you'd see them on TV, and yeah, and it was kind of amazing, you know.
And so, and once you started doing it, I mean, it sounds like it was kind of the fact that you were going to see comedy may have been a little bit of a secret to your parents. What about when you started actually doing it yourself?
They knew I was like making stuff, you know, so they knew I was really interested in it. They were always really supportive. It was always like, oh my God, yeah, go do it. But also like, what are you really going to do? Mm-hmm. Like that's all it was. It was not don't do it. It was, oh man, that's great. It sucks that you're going to have to stop and like make money, you know? So that was always the attitude, like do it as long as you can, but you have to figure out what you're going to do. And so I went to school for political science and economics. Yeah, I was just not a good student. Like, it was not going to happen. I didn't hold up very long.
So at some point, they must have realized that you were actually going to go into comedy full time.
Yeah, well, I dropped out of school. I mean, I said I was taking a semester off. Mm-hmm. And my dad was like, you know, you're not. He not that he was stopping me, but he was like, if you do, you won't go back. Nobody takes a semester off. That was his thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, it's just a semester. Because at the time, I was taking like an acting program in New York. I was like doing both. So I was like going to Rutgers in Newark, and then I'd go to this acting program in New York. And I was like, let me just finish the acting program, and then I'll go back and I'll, you know, get the poli sci degree. And it was like not taken well, but my dad was like, okay, he really has always let me make my own choices. Mm-hmm. And so I drop out, and then like 3 weeks later, I booked a pilot because I had been like auditioning a bit.
Yeah.
And so I booked a pilot in New York, and then I shot it in LA, and then it got picked up. And 2 months later, I just moved to LA. I moved to LA when I would have been taking finals if I stayed in school. And it was just like this crazy fate thing where it was the only thing that would have got me out here as early as it did, because I don't know what I would have done, you know. And so it was really, really cool.
And has your family seen the show, and what do they think of it, or if they haven't, are you nervous for them to see it?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm shooting my stand-up special
this
Sunday. And so I'm going to show them the show after I shoot the special, because I think that they will probably have a lot to say. I haven't read any of the reviews of my show, because I'm waiting for the review from my parents. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the one that I'm like, I wonder what they are going to think. And I just didn't want to show them anything, because I care about what they think. And so I didn't want to be influenced by how they reacted. Even their silence would have been like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to make them uncomfortable. I don't want them to, because the show takes a lot of swings. And even for them, I didn't want to put them in a situation where like they have to feel the anxiety of like, what are people going to think? Okay. Like, I didn't want them to live in the purgatory of pre-TV show coming out, you know, because they'd have to just be like, oh man, what are people, like the anxiety that comes with it. They would have felt it for me because they care about me.
Yeah.
And so waiting until now is kind of like the best plan.
And will you watch it with them, or will you just give it to them to watch on their own?
Oh, I will give it to them, and as I'm getting on a flight somewhere, I'll make sure I don't even have phone reception, ideally.
Coming up after the break, Rami Yusuf talks about the episode of his new show that combines masturbation with 9/11.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7 while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. One episode that I think is likely to get some attention is the, I believe it's episode 4, which is the flashback to on and around September 11th, 2001, and your character as a young adolescent. And it kind of combines 9/11 with your character discovering masturbation.
Yeah.
So can you talk about where that idea for that episode came from? And you know, obviously without spoiling anything, why you wanted to tell that specific story?
Yeah. I think it was like 2 years ago or something, I was on stage. The Laugh Factory has these like midnight shows, and sometimes it's like the best show you've ever been on. It's like a concert and people mm-hmm. are up. And then sometimes it is the quietest thing ever. And I really love the quiet nights there. And I was on stage and I was just talking about that time, and it kind of connected to me that, man, like 9/11 and me jerking off for the first time happened in like the same year. You know, like it was like, I don't know, I was in fifth grade, and then like in sixth grade, I'm like, you're like discovering yourself and you're like, you want a girlfriend all of a sudden. And wow, all these things happen at the same time. And, you know, being in Jersey so close to it. And I mean, one of my first stand-up bits was like, you know, the name of the first World Trade Center bomber is Ramzi Youssef. Everyone thought we were related, including me. Like that's the fear. That was like the root fear. And so I was just thinking a lot about that time. And I think that when these things happen, we don't really talk about how it affects kids. And this show in 10 episodes, the only time we talk about terrorism is in that episode, because I was really only interested in exploring it from the vantage point of a kid. And I kind of was like, well, okay, cool. What if we looked at those themes? And a big part of this show is just trying to say, hey, we're humans. Because I think a lot of people only know us defined by our headlines. And so what is the most human thing that could be happening under one of the most devastating headlines? And then what would it look like if those things happened at the same time? And so that was the seed of it, of the idea. And then it, you know, incorporates a lot of surreal elements and stuff that I had been wanting to do for a while. And so, yeah, that episode is like really personal to me, obviously. And it's the one, you know, I'm not in it.
Yeah.
And so I got to direct it, which was great.
Yeah.
It was really fun to get to play there.
And in terms of your own experience, you know, being a fifth, sixth grader when all that was happening and being in New Jersey, I mean, what was that like for you? Is it, I mean, I'm sure it's reflected somewhat in this episode, but mm-hmm. just from your own personal perspective, what was that like?
I think it's just like a lot of anxiety. It's a lot of, again, it's weird to be afraid of yourself and where you come from. And I think ultimately it did this thing where it probably started the nature of my introspective feelings towards myself, you know, mm-hmm. like my favorite part about comedy is that me interrogating myself. And if I think back, truly, I was probably in fifth grade kind of interrogating myself and interrogating my family and being like, yo, people are saying this is because of us. Is that true? You know, and that's just a very kid thing to think. You know, as an adult, you can rationalize it. As a child, you already don't fit in, you know, like there's already all these things going on. And so at the time, it's like now you sit with a therapist and you're like, oh man, I was really anxious last month. I didn't think I was, but I was. And it's the same thing. At the time, you don't realize how much you're internalizing. So I don't think like I would have characterized my time as a kid then as like horrifying or really depressing. I mean, I think I probably felt like I was as scared as anyone else. But, you know, you step a couple of years forward and you look back and you're kind of like, oh, that was pretty intense. There were a lot of emotions going on there, and just the way that I viewed the world. And at the time, I think I was just like really worried.
Yeah.
And really, you know, and really cared a lot.
But you've been able to take some of those experiences, whether it's that or Trump's Muslim ban, and really make comedy out of it in a way that you don't see too often, at least, you know, from Muslim comics. So how did you kind of start to go about, this is part of what I want my comedy to be about?
It comes from like not wanting to be afraid. So it's like, I don't want to feel that way. I don't want to feel afraid. I don't want to feel anxious. I also don't want to make fun of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something here. You know, there's
yeah.
something to this thing that is terrible that, and I think what I look at a lot too is my privilege within those situations, right? Because even for me, I'm not somebody who, a lot of my experience of being someone who's Muslim is I'm not visibly Muslim. You know, I think people look at me and I could be hipster from ex-hipster town. Like it doesn't really, you know, I don't present, it's like a second layer thing. And so I'm aware of that. And because of that, I'm not going to talk about being profiled or stereotyped or any of those things.
Right.
I'm more interested in what profiling and stereotyping do I do? What are my hypocrisies? How am I experiencing this thing? And so if I could be an anchor point of just human emotion around these things, then we can maybe even bring, you know, just a little bit of light to the humanity of the people who go through the other side of these things and aren't really talked about.
In terms of the stereotyping, though, I'm curious if that came up at all when you were starting out as an actor, because, you know, I think we've all heard a lot of stories about what it's like to be, you know, a young Arab
Or,
you know, actor with an Arab name and the kind of parts that you get offered.
They would bring me in for all those and they'd be so disappointed. They'd just be like, why does this guy look Jewish? Like, they would be like, what's happening? Like, and I would be upset and I'd go home and be like, oh man, I wasn't terroristy enough to be the terrorist. It wasn't even like I had some integrity of not wanting to do it. I was like, they wouldn't cast me.
Yeah, that wasn't your lane. So I want to talk about your stand-up as well, because I got to see you run your hour at UCB a couple weeks ago.
You were there?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool.
And it was awesome. It was a lot of fun. So that was sort of part of your preparation for this new special that you're taping on HBO. I mean, that's a big deal.
I'm excited, man. Yeah, it's going to be really fun. I mean, so much of the backbone of the show is stand-up. And I guess having seen the show and seen the hour, you can see the overlap. It's not a ton because I kind of am like trying to I burned a lot of stand-up material in the show. And so I tried to write new stuff for the hour. Stand-up is my favorite thing. Like making the show is the laugh 2 years later. I love like being in the room and just really feeling it out. And so, getting to do it at a place that like HBO is so awesome. Like, I'm so excited to do it there. Yeah, I feel really lucky with like the two partners that I've been able to do stuff with. Like, Hulu is like kind of a dream. You know, we were really close to doing it with FX, but there was something about doing it with Hulu that was like, you know, and I love FX. I would love to go do something with them too. But, you know, it was just at the time I was like, oh, this is cool. They really want to do this. You know, like they just like want new comedy. You know, and FX like has Atlanta, has Louis, and to be part of that would have been so cool. But then you get to go somewhere that like doesn't, and they're really excited. And they just, there's just like a different level of like energy and championing behind it. And so I just feel really lucky to be there. And then HBO is like, dope, man. There's like, they're doing 5 specials this year. It's like in the sea of comedy, you know. It's kind of fun to just be there I'm really excited about it.
So how have the preparations been going? You've been running the hour a lot, and how have the audiences been, and just what's that experience been like?
Yeah, it's been really, I was just in Spokane this weekend. Spokane, Washington. I had a really good time. I mean, I did 3 shows there. And one of them in particular was just so interesting because it was like, I was in Seattle. So I ran it in Seattle. Seattle was amazing. Crowd was like New York. It's like a New York, LA crowd. Spokane is like more Idaho than anything. I mean, it's like right on the border there. And the reactions from the crowd to a lot of my material were so different than a New York, LA thing. And so it turned into this like argumentative kind of thing. I mean, people were like actively booing, but then like between active boos and like big like laughs. So there'd be like a big laugh, and then like a minute later it's like boo, like actually boo. And I really liked it though, because I have fun like kind of dropping the material and just kind of getting into it and figuring out. And I've actually built a lot of bits from having a show where I tanked. Like, it was just like I bombed, but later that night I was like, oh man, the beginning of that conversation with that woman when I like abandoned the material, that's like the bit I want to do now.
And is the booing more about them just disagreeing with what you're saying, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I actually think that they liked me. They just didn't like what I was saying. It was really funny because I was like talking to one of the people afterwards and she was like, you seem sweet, but that was some bullshit. You know, like that kind of thing. And like, she like wasn't into what I was talking about. And I like that stuff though. I mean, like I feel like at a comedy club, it's one of the few places where people aren't on their phones and you can kind of have a conversation that you wouldn't have somewhere else. And it's really fun.
I don't want to burn the joke or make you tell it here, but there's a joke that you tell about 9/11 as well in your hour that I think I could imagine gets some interesting reactions around the world. But it seems like you embrace the awkwardness as well. I mean, that's something I think you have in common with Gerard Carmichael. In terms of liking the quiet rooms or liking like embracing that kind of that uncomfortableness as well. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think that's how we both became friends, is that we both like talking to people. So it's like the comedy part of it is the part that comes after liking to talk to people. So of course I want it to be funny and like that's my job, but there is this real love for like just getting to be in conversation. And so I lead with the point of how I'm feeling. So this way, even if it doesn't land, it's like, well, at least, you know how I feel about something, you know. But the punchline's there, you know, it's like it's coming and I work really, you know, I love finding that. But that's something that we both really connect on, which is, it's okay. It's all right. It's fine. Like if it sits a little oddly, and there is something even really more fun about that. And that's something that I think hits over to the show too. I mean, I think that somebody was talking about the show and online someone said something and they were like, oh man, the show, someone had seen some episodes and they were like, they seemed to like not really be into it a little bit, but they're like, oh, it made me just feel uneasy. And I was like, yeah, well, that's good. I mean, like, that's great. Like, I'm not, it's the point isn't to like make something that brings a resolution or provides an answer. I think like going to comedy for answers is really dangerous. I think about this all the time with like Jon Stewart in The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Loved him. Like, I would watch him in high school and I was like, oh man, this dude is like sticking up for Muslims and he's like, he's telling the truth. And then it became this thing where people were like, I don't get my news from the news. I get it from Jon Stewart The Daily Show, which is really beautiful for what he did. It also fucks up comedy because it makes it this thing where it's like there's this expectation to go to comedy for your truths and for your justice. Mm-hmm. And that's not the point. That's not what this is about. It's not, the whole point of comedy is that it's not correct. And you see a lot of comedians like rallying against political correctness.
Yeah.
There's nuances to that conversation. A lot of times it's someone just wanting to say the N-word for no real reason.
Right.
Or a lot of times it's someone just like being lazy about not writing a joke. But the true part to it is that comedy shouldn't be correct. It should just be emotionally correct. So it shouldn't be like factually correct. It shouldn't be like maybe correct in how you treat someone or this or that. But like it should be about real feelings and real emotions in the subconscious. Conscious. And so that, I think, is the only job that it should set out to do. And if that leaves you with an uneasy feeling, that's good. And I like that.
Yeah, I mean, and for something to be funny, in a way, it has to be a little bit unexpected. So if you're just seeing somebody say what you already agree with or what what you think, then that's not necessarily going to be funny.
Right. But I do believe that comedy has been put in this place where that is what people think it is. I think people go out to a show to hear like a collection of their own Facebook comments said by somebody into a mic. Like they want to just hear you shit on Trump. They want to just hear you say that this is what the world should look like. And maybe you give it a little bit of a punch, you know, mm-hmm. but like it's tricky. And that's why I really appreciate going to Spokane and being on the border where a bunch of people voted for Trump. It's not even like, even just in terms of a comedy show, like it was fucking fun. And it, like, even though they didn't like what I was saying, like it got rough and all of that. And it was cool. Sometimes you're in LA and if you are not saying the most like on point thing and using the correct, like people will just like lose their shit in a way that is worse than the boos in Spokane. Cause the boos in Spokane were kind of like, hey man, fuck you. The boos in LA are like a silent, I am so much better than you.
Yeah,
and a silent, like you are inferior and ignorant and you deserve to be canceled and you shouldn't have a career and like all this shit. The people in Spokane just boo you and they'll either hang out and drink more or they'll leave. There's just differences in how that plays out.
Coming up, Rami Yusuf on his family's unlikely relationship with Donald Trump. So one other thing I learned from your stand-up is that your dad actually worked for Trump at somewhere in the 90s. What's that all about?
Yeah, my dad worked at one of his hotels. Yeah. So it was really interesting because it's like my dad knew him. My dad knew his family. And so he kind of saw the way that he did business. And it's funny because I think my dad enjoyed working for him. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I don't know that my dad saw all of the things that, you know, we now see. I think that people are good at hiding parts of themselves, or I don't know that Trump ever tried to hide it. I mean, I think Trump publicly has always been a certain way.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing that I really understood from my dad was kind of like, yeah, the dude would come in, he kind of bust balls and whatever and this and that. But like, you know, and we all got vacation and we all got like, you know, this and that. And my dad, he started working at that hotel like very shortly after he got his citizenship. And so it's less even about how Trump acted at that time or whatever that relationship was. To me, the interesting thing is just like, I know for a fact that this guy's life is possible because of people like my dad, that immigrants are the backbone of his businesses. And though we don't know how much those businesses actually make, they are a big part of how he's gotten to where he's at. And so it's not even about, is he a nice guy? Is he a this? Is he a that? It's the people that he is trying to completely exclude from the conversation and dehumanize are the ones that have provided him with even the smallest shreds of legitimacy that he has. Mm-hmm. And so just that fact has always been, as he's ascended the way that he has, it's just baffling to me.
Yeah.
Just because I know it.
Yeah. How has that experience either colored either your or your dad's thoughts about Trump now that he's president?
I mean, my dad was just like really disappointed. I mean, I remember he was just kind of like, oh, Donald. He was just like, he's like, this is awful, you know? And obviously, he never supported him when he was running or anything like that. I mean, I think the second he started running, he was just kind of like, oh, man, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Because I think my dad sometimes would be like, I think he's a better guy than this. Why is he doing this? You know, he just didn't want to believe it. And for me, it just complicated it. I like very much think his presidency is really dangerous. I think he continues to make that clear. I think even his supporters are very confused. You know, I mean, even when I was in Spokane the other night, I was like, are you guys like on board with all this? Like, for real, for real? And the dude was just like, hey, man, you know, it's pros and cons. Like that. That's yeah. Like kind of where he, you know, they know, you know, there isn't this like, I don't think there's as much blind love as we think there is. I know there's factions or whatever. It's super dangerous. But I think knowing that fact, probably as I first started to talk about him, it just complicated it in a way for mm-hmm. me. And that's kind of what not complicated in the clarity of what was going on with him, but almost like I wanted my approach to be complicated in how I talked about him, because I think just the straight up attack on him it's just boring
yeah.
on a certain level. And I found I do this bit about him that even in a place like Spokane where like they were so for him, people were laughing and people were like, yeah, that's true. You know, like, yeah, you know, like there's, I think there's a way to talk about it. But yeah, it's just knowing really just that fact of like, man, dude, like my dad worked for you and like did so much for that family. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. In the show, we see some of your relatives in support of the Muslim ban, which your character doesn't quite understand. Is that based on real conversations you've had with people?
Yeah. You know, the family in the show is pretty... The good thing is, I think when my family watches the show, they'll be like, oh, this isn't our family.
Right.
I mean, it's very much, you know, an amalgamation of a lot of people in the community. But when I went to Cairo around the elections, I was baffled by how many people were like, no, he's a strong man, you know, like he'll, and it's because we're, you know, our countries, a lot of the ones that we come from are, you know, have had dictatorships. And so maybe we're just used to the vibe
yeah.
where it's kind of like, oh yeah, this is what we're familiar with, this feeling, you know? And I think a lot of it comes with that. I think that there's an element of like people not understanding, you know, a woman being present, whatever it might've been. But there were a couple conversations I had where I was like, fuck, people really feel like this, huh? And you know, it happens all over. I mean, it's like it's happening all over the world, right? I mean, Israel just reelected Netanyahu. Like, it's like, how? It's a thing that's happening. And so, yeah, that is, I think, the only conversation we have about Trump in the show
mm-hmm.
is some family members in Cairo who call him a strong man.
Yeah. So I think whenever there's a, you know, a show that hasn't even come out yet, it's hard to talk about, you know, what comes next. But I'm curious, you know, since you said you made the character of Rami a little stuck, a little sort of what had happened if you hadn't gotten to where you are now. If you do get a chance to make more of this show, where do you see the character moving and evolving? And do you think, you know, can you imagine him getting into comedy and sort of trying to tell that story? Or have you thought about that at all?
Yeah, I've thought about it. Comedy will never be a part of the show. Hmm. We would joke, actually, that in the alternate universe of the Rami show, there is no such thing as stand-up comedy. It's not even a form of... it's something I'm not interested in exploring on screen. I think part of what we're trying to do is be as universal as possible while being really specific. And the way to do that is, like, obviously focusing on the human condition. But I don't think anybody gives a fuck about, like, oh man, this open mic, you know? Like, I don't think there's any genuine tension. Like, I don't think people all over the world can be like, oh, I hope people like his joke, you know? Like, it's like, it's not, you know, it just doesn't feel, yeah, it doesn't feel like something that we would do here. But I'm really excited to, like, step the character out of, you know, where he's at, where he lives at home and he's in his late 20s, you know? And so something as small as even just moving out will, and even if that sounds like a little cliche on its face, there's a lot of spaces of what it looks like when you move out and separate yourself from a family like this one.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of consequences to that and it affects a lot of things. And I'm really excited to see a lot of the other characters grow. And you know, you've seen the show. We really take time to focus on those other characters and step away from mine. And so there's a lot of things to track. And it's the idea of doing a second season would be so exciting because we're not laying groundwork anymore. It's like it's all there. And then now we're really like we can have fun. You know who these people are and we can really get into it.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, what I like to do is kind of go through a few milestones in your career that we didn't get to talk about and get some quick, just sort of first memory or story that comes to mind about that experience. So the first would be the first time you got on stage to do stand-up.
Oh, yeah. I was in New York, Eastville Comedy Club. It was, I think, Anna Dresden was a comedian. She had a show. And I had, like, written a couple things down. And maybe I had done a mic, but, like, this was, like, this is kind of the first show I remember. And I went on stage and I was so in my head that I forgot to take my backpack off. And I did stand up with a backpack on and then I got off and then Sabrina Jalice went on and did like a 3-minute impression of me doing everything in my life with a backpack on. Like she started like miming me fucking but with a backpack on. And it was really, I was like horrified. Yeah. And I was like, oh man, that's also really funny. I don't remember what year that was. That must have been like, that probably was like 2011 or something, 2010, 2011. And then I probably like didn't do it for a couple months and then...
So you mentioned this, but your first big TV role was on the sitcom See Dad Run, which starred Scott Baio.
Yeah.
This is probably before we knew he was a Trump supporter. So what was that experience like?
Yeah, man, those were the days when I knew him as a Romney supporter, you know, much more, I mean, those are the good old days.
Yeah.
It was an amazing experience doing that show. It was, I just had like the best time. Everyone was like cast, crew, Scott, everyone was awesome. Just like really, really cool. And yeah, man, it's shocking with him. I wouldn't say shocking, but it's just the way, you know, sometimes people like publicly put on a really good face and privately are like pretty terrible. And he's someone where the things he does and says publicly, I can't even connect to the person that I know privately. Mm-hmm. He's someone who like was really, really good to me. And like, you know, I feel like I have a good relationship with him. And he was someone who like advocated for me. I mean, he was the star of the show. I was like a brand new person out of nowhere. And there were times where he would be like, can you give Rami better scene than this? Like truly like just like fought for, I think I was like a recurring and he was like, no, he should be a series regular. Like stuff that like impacted my life, you know? And at the same time, the stuff he says in a front-facing way and publicly and a lot of those things are, couldn't be further than what I think, and there are things that I think are dangerous. And there lies the complication.
So I think you had your TV stand-up debut on Colbert, is that right?
Yes.
Which is awesome, and you can go find that on YouTube and watch it. So what was that experience like?
Oh, it was amazing, man. I mean, it was a really cool thing. It was also this kind of interesting thing because you prep your set and there's like a transcript of it and then they look at it and they approve it. And at some point, I guess it was like the night before, I got a call and they were like, hey, so one of these jokes we're not comfortable with. You can't really say. And it's this joke where, you know, I talk about believe in God, and then I say that everyone should submit to Islam. And so, it's like the way it plays out in the clip is it's a joke that I'd been doing, and I knew it worked, but all they had at CBS was, like, the script, and they were like, wait, he's saying what? He's doing what? You got to pull it. And so they called me the night before, and also at this time, too, this was, like, when Trump had called out Colbert. It was like Trump had this, like, sit down and he went for Colbert, and the show I was on was the day after. So they were like he literally, Trump was like, the FCC's got to look into Colbert. And then I'm performing on Colbert, and they're like, what the fuck is going on? And so I get this call, and they're like, you got to pull it or you can't come tomorrow. And I'm like, okay, I'll pull it. Sure, whatever. I didn't have any intention to do that, but I was like, let's talk in person. Like, I feel like if we can see each other. And so I got there, and, you know, I'm talking to the producer, and you know, he's a valid concern. This sounds crazy. I mean, this is like, you know, and I was like, hey, man, you know, I respect what you're saying, but, like, I can't do this set if I don't have – it's the closer of the set. I've been working on the set for a month, you know, like – and so he was like – so uncertain about it, and I was like, all right, how about this? Like, we, if it doesn't go well, just don't air it. Show's not live. And he was like, let's see what happens. Okay, let's see what happens. and so, and then we did it, and you know, and he came back, and he was like, I love to be wrong.
I still think we're gonna be okay. I really do, because I believe in God, like God, not yoga, but. And I know that's a weird thing to say. I get it. You know, religious culture can be crazy. I don't agree with all of it. I grew up in a town where I watched my gay friends struggle to come out to the religious community. And now I live in LA, where I'm a religious person struggling to come out to the gay community and tell them what I think. And they're just like, you believe in God? Dude, that's so gay. I just, for me, God is hope. That there's more to life than what's in front of us. You know, that even if things seem impossible, there's still a chance that it could be okay. And I'm not trying to be preachy. I'm really not. Like, all I'm trying to say is just submit to Islam, because it's the truth. And that's the only way you'll be saved. Seriously, that's the only way. Trust me. Gotta do
it. It was so amazing to do it on that show. I love Colbert. I mean, I think he's the best, and he's just so awesome. And I'm doing his show next week.
Oh, awesome.
So I'm really excited to, like, actually be in conversation with him this time.
And yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. That was 2 years ago, like, this week.
Wow.
You know, it was.
And then the last one that I wanted to hit was appearing on Mr. Robot with your fellow Egyptian-American actor, Rami Malek.
Yes.
How did that kind of happen, and what was that like?
Oh, man, it was so cool. I mean, I got the audition. You know, I was living in L.A., but I got the audition while I was in New York. And they were like, hey, can you put yourself on tape? Because they thought I was in L.A., but I was like, no, I'm in New York. Like, I want to go in. And so they hadn't been seeing anyone for that role yet, but they, like, were like, okay, cool, you can come since you're here. I'd only had the sides for, like, a couple of hours, and I just went in and did it. And then I forgot about it. I was like, okay, cool. And then, like, a month later, they were like, hey, you got the thing. And I was like, fuck, this is so cool. And because it was a show that I really loved, and it was – honestly, it was very inspiring, too, because it's like, you know, Sam Esmail and Rami are both Egyptians, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was cool to see them just – killing it. I mean, Sam was such a cool director, and Rami's obviously, like, amazing, and, like, the dynamic that we got to play in the show was really fun. It was for a show that doesn't – Sam's really good at employing comedy. It doesn't call itself a comedy, but, like, he has these – every season he has, like, a character or, like, a thing that, you know, brings that. And so to get to do that for the season that I was on and be a part of that was – it was really cool. It was – I got to be in this one episode that they did – they shot it to look like a oneer. And so the work that they did – to nail that on a technical level was really cool. And I loved it, too, because it kind of was this, like, this rush of, like, stand-up energy where you're like, oh, shit, like, okay, they've been coming around the corner for the last 3 minutes.
Don't fuck it up.
By the time, do not fuck it up by the time it comes. And so sometimes, like, you're doing acting, and you're like, ah, I can nail this, whatever. But this was, I was like, oh, shit, I got to get this down right. Otherwise, all these people who don't know me are going to hate me, and they're going to be like, fucking bootleg Rami. We fucked up the shot. We only like our Rami. I knew some shit was going to be talked, and so no, it was really fun.
Finally, I like to end the show by asking, what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? It could be a movie, it could be a TV show, stand up, something that just happened in your life. First thing that comes to mind.
I love memes and I love like online shit actually. Like, and there's this guy, Nathan Plywee. I don't know how to say his last name, but he does this Instagram account called Strange Planet. And it's like aliens doing really basic human things. And it's just, it's so funny the way he like breaks stuff down. And so a really good friend of mine passed earlier this year, my friend Kevin Barnett, who you know, I'm sure you know of. And so our thing was like memes. Like we like fucking loved memes. And so like we were constantly have like long, like I remember having like a 3-hour conversation about why a meme was better than like the best stand-up bit. You know, like we just went into it. Like it's because you get to see the visual and it's one statement. It's like, it's the economy of a perfect joke, but you also get to see like the emotion in the eyes, but then you can just send it. And you know, I mean, it was just like this whole like thing. And so I've been like dying, you know, just like cracking up looking at these things and thinking about him, but also like this account is like really, it's really amazing. Yeah.
All right. Well, everyone check that out.
Yeah, check it out.
All right, Rami, thank you so much for coming out today.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me. This is really fun.
Awesome.
Thanks, man.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that throwback episode with Rami Youssef. I'll be rooting for him at the Emmys next weekend. In the meantime, please help us out by giving this podcast a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you for an all-new episode next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.